Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep begins now.
There are over 550 million firearms in worldwide circulation. That's one firearm for every 12 people on the planet. The only question is, how do we arm the other 11?
Selling guns is like selling vacuum cleaners. You make calls, pound the pavement. I supply to every army but the Salvation Army.
Can you bring me the gun of Rambo?
Part one, two, or three?
I've only seen part one.
Of all the weapons in the vast Soviet arsenal, nothing was more profitable than Avtomat Kalashnikova, model of 1947, more commonly known as the AK-47 or Kalashnikov. It's the world's most popular assault rifle, a weapon all fighters love. An elegantly simple 9-pound amalgamation of forged steel and plywood. It doesn't break, jam, or overheat. It will shoot whether it's covered in mud or filled with sand. It's so easy, even a child can use it. And they do. The Soviets put the gun on a coin. Mozambique put it on their flag. Since the end of the Cold War, the Kalashnikov has become the Russian people's greatest export. After that comes vodka, caviar, and suicidal novelists. One thing's for sure, no one was lining up to buy their cars.
Thank you for joining us there. Hello, Dawn Taylor, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm fine. All right. So what is today? Is today Thursday?
Today is Thursday.
Today is Thursday. All right. So we had the... We had a little interference happening right there at the beginning over the... if you heard some additional audio sort of blending with the sound of Nicolas Cage. Here's the thing about that Nicolas Cage cut that we just played. Because I think we had like two sources going at once, which I have subsequently remedied. The thing about that is, that clip is cursed. I now have to go back and I have to fix it in post, which I really will do today because that's just inexcusable. Every single time I've tried to play that show open, something has gone wrong. It's like the clip itself... It's like it was recorded on top of an Indian burial ground or something. Yeah. Every time I try to play that, something... The last time I tried to do it, I think that was the day that, like, one of the computers just, like, turned off. The computer that was responsible for that sound just, it just sort of quit. It just sort of quit playing.
So was there, like, a song playing?
Yeah, there was a dual audio thing happening there, which I fixed. But I don't blame myself so much as I blame Nicolas Cage. Or perhaps I should say I blame Victor Boat. That was actually by request, which is why I am now further obligated to actually remedy the whole thing here in just a bit.
So you didn't just disappoint me.
I broke a heart.
And our listeners in general, but you disappointed a specific person who wanted something from you.
Well, why should today be any different than any other day of my life? I stepped on a dream, not unlike crushing a butterfly in a Ray Bradbury story.
Someone in the text box suggests if the tape is cursed... You could just make a copy of it and give it to 7 of your friends and make them listen to it. And then after they die, you'll be... That was that thing from The Ring with the tape.
I don't remember that it went to 7 friends.
No, it didn't have to go to 7 friends. Just somebody else had to watch it.
I just remember watching the movie and trying to figure out, like, what Bill Pullman had to do with anything. Like, was it ever explained why he had to jump off the patio at the beginning or whatever? He's on the balcony at the beginning, and he jumps off, and I get the idea. I get the fact that...
I think he was scared. I don't know. I don't remember. It's been so long.
But, you know, if you watch the movie The Ring, it opens with Bill Pullman waking up, and he's standing outside the patio, and everybody's saying, what's going on? Why is Bill Pullman in this movie? I wasn't promised any Pullman. And then his wife looks over at him, and he smiles at her, and then he just dives off the patio. And just snuffs it right there. And then later on, it's revealed that he was having some sort of an affair with somebody or other. But it's never really explained what that has to do with him plummeting off the balcony.
I don't know.
All right. Thanks for playing.
Was that the first one or the second one? Because the second one was the one that had the insanely creepy CGI elk deer that attack the car. That don't look like any animal that's actually Earth, and it was just really horrible CGI. And
no, I think I must have missed that.
Laughably done.
I got off the train right after the first one because you know the thing is the guy who makes the Ring movies, you know he's made the same movie like 6 times now because he made the Ring, and he made the Ring and he made the Ring 2. I don't know if he's the same guy who made the Grudge or not. Or am I confusing it with The Grudge? I don't even know anymore. But the point is, what was the one with Sarah Michelle Gellar and Bill Pullman? Is that The Ring or The Grudge? That's
The
Grudge.
That would be The Grudge.
So that guy...
They're easy to confuse because they're these American remakes of these Asian horror movies that the Asian horror movies themselves are very similar, and then these are American remakes of them.
And so then the guy who made The Grudge, not only is there the American version and the sequel, he actually made each of those movies three different times. Because he made one for theatrical release, he made what is an independent release, and then he made them as television films. So that is a guy who quite literally has two scripts from which he has made six films without adding or changing anything. And all that, I just say, well done, sir. All right. It is 503-505-6964 if you would like to join us today. 503-505-6964.
Like that on the show we congratulate intellectual laziness.
I'm for whatever helps a guy, you know, get paid. Whatever. If it makes you feel any better, which it may not, we were being blended with some Sinatra music at the very beginning. So, yes, that was not your imagination. I had this. Somebody says, I've just subscribed to the show. I'm now listening. He sent us a Skype message, and he says, long-time listener, first-time Skyper, immediately followed by an all-caps follow-up in which he says, God damn, that sounds awful. Why did I type first-time Skyper? Anyway, thank you for the program. Thank you for listening, sir. I appreciate it. If you would like to engage with us via the telephone today, it's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. You can also email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com. Don Taylor can be reached at don@rickemerson.com. That is dawn@rickemerson.com. And the text box is up and running right now as I speak these words to you. Coming up later on today, Ms. Anna Griffin will be here from the Oregonian. Portland columnist Anna Griffin will join us in the studio. And you were writing down something that we were going to ask her.
Yes, indeed. We're going to ask her about the changes to the downtown beer sales.
That's right, because they got the whole thing over there. They're not going to let you buy like a single beer or a single...
Right.
Are they already stopping you from buying a single malt beverage? Is that the deal? Is that already the case?
I don't know. Yeah, because this is going to... They want to get rid of all malt beverages over, you know, 5.75% alcohol and fortified wines entirely. And then also single beers.
All right. It's all very confusing. So we'll talk to Anna Griffin about that later on. We have another installment of today's Pop Culture Authority. Pop Culture Authority answering the question, from where does Tennessee Williams come? Which is a thing that I have to say, quite honestly, I'd never pondered. I'd never thought about it. It had never occurred to me that it was something that wouldn't have an obvious answer. So later on today, we will all learn at the same time. That's coming up. We have a penis watch coming up today. Taser watch coming up today, and a musical request that we'll get to later on as well. Don Taylor's tracking the following stories for you on this Thursday.
Portland will be adding additional green bike boxes. The Oxford Dictionary has added their new words that they do every single year. And the Pope. The Pope is on the move. The Pope...
You really have no idea what any of these stories are about, do you?
Sure I do. Bike boxes, dictionary, Pope.
Okay.
Pope.
She's Dawn Taylor. You'll get to hear more of her more of her news delivery and informational style here in just a few minutes.
It's fun to say Pope.
It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. How was your evening, Dawn Taylor?
My evening was fine. It was good. It was pretty non-eventful. We have this one organization that I write for online is doing a changeover in that.
By changeover, do you mean firing?
No. Well, weirdly enough, no. What's going on is the corporate masters that own everything have decided to try and blend together some of their different entities into one big giant conglomeration, which everyone's really looking forward to.
That's always the key to quality right there, is to increase the size of the company until you're just owned by an oligarchy.
Literally, I have no idea how my editors and stuff really feel about this. We've been getting the, no, seriously, this is going to be great emails. And then people in the comments section on the site itself have been going, this is going to suck. I remember when this happened over at, you know, insert website here. And I don't read it anymore because it blows down. You know, so I have no idea how how awesome this is going to be or not. So far, I looked at the site this morning after things got changed over. It looks fine.
Is that why
okay.
you're checking your email after the show sometimes and then just sort of groaning and like clenching your eyes shut?
A little bit, yeah.
You
haven't
really
been wondering what's going to go on with that.
You didn't really tell me what all that was about, and I figured it wasn't my place to pry. But I would look over after the show, and you would just be going like, looking at the screen, and then I would just say, okay, I guess I'll just be quiet for a while over here and let you work out whatever it is you're dealing with.
But we were told not to actually post anything or do any work yesterday because they were doing all of the technical stuff. So I had last night just off, guilt-free, to just sit around and do whatever I wanted to do, which was nice. And then this morning, I hurt myself before I came to work, so that's always fun.
What is up with you? Have you considered that, speaking of bad horror films, have you considered that maybe you avoided death narrowly at some point in the past, and so the universe is just... But rather than just having, like, a logging truck taking you out all at once, that really creation is just taking you off an inch at a time.
I think so. I think I am slowly disintegrating.
First the hips, and then it goes to... So, like, first it gets one leg, then the other, then you get a cold the other day, then you injure yourself last mm-hmm. night. What was the nature of the injury?
Oh, it was actually this morning on my way to work. It was... I was doing that last, like, go into the bathroom to comb my hair one last time before I run out the door. And my foot slipped on some water on the bathroom floor, and I did the whole thing. My foot just kind of went, off to like a few inches to one side. But it was the foot that's attached to the leg that has my bad knee on it. So I just yanked the bad knee really hard and went, yipe, and made some scary noise and frightened the dog. And then I thought... And then I stood there for a minute going, yeah, and then it started to feel better. I was like, oh, it's not so bad, and did the whole, I'll just walk it off. This doesn't hurt. And then didn't really think about the fact that that's my my accelerating and braking foot driving to work. So the whole way driving to work, I was just going, ow, god damn it, oh, god.
That's fantastic.
All the way into work. And then I get here, and you walk in, and I go, I hurt myself. You go, I did too.
Yeah, but I don't even really have any explanation for it. It's just one of those days where I woke up feeling like somebody just beat me with a lead pipe while I was asleep. Which happens to me a lot. And so this is going to be one of those things.
I blame the dogs.
You'll find this out. Like, there'll be a news story at some point in the future where, the man had apparently claimed of aches and pains for some time. His wife said she had no idea. And then they'll cut to, like, a security camera, some sort of closed circuit footage where my wife is drugging me before I go to bed and then just beating me with a 9-iron while I slumber away.
I'm telling you, it's probably the dogs. I think if you set up one of those little cameras with the night vision thing, like in Paranormal Activity, you'll find out that the dogs are sneaking in at night. With like Max is sneaking in, he has a tiny little rubber hose,
or maybe
he's just pounding you over the kidneys,
Or they're just dosing me with lead or something while I, when I'm not looking, he's just putting like strontium 90 into my coffee cup or something. There's something bizarre going on, and this whole week has just been. I mean, at the top of the show when we had the Sinatra going over the Lord of War thing there, which I now feel like at some point during the show I'm obligated to like play again. Because we had a guy, James, I think his name was, who requested. Because the deal is, just to side note for a second, the reason we started again with Lord of War, which I played a few weeks ago, is A, because the last time I tried to play it, it screwed up. There was some sort of glitch with that. And so I thought, well, this is a way to take care of it, finally get it played correctly. Which didn't happen, of course. And also because they just arrested, like, 2 days ago, the guy that Nicolas Cage's character in Lord of War is based on, Victor Boot. That's why I was making the observation with him at the top. Because he's... Bruce Egler tipped me off to this because he's a big fan of that movie too, and he was like, hey, did you see the guy that they arrested the guy that Nicolas Cage's character was based on, Lord of War? Because it's one of those things where like the guy, they knew where he was. It's not like he was in hiding.
Yeah.
Because he's a legitimate businessman who's been unjustly accused of being like an arms dealer. He's been living in Thailand, I guess, which is just weird. I guess that's it's like a pass, go collect $200. It's like commit many felonies, go to Thailand, where they just turn a blind eye to like everything. But the U.S. government finally paid off the right number of people and they contacted. They had the right amount of graft that happened, and the cops agreed to go arrest him, and they just, like, kicked in his door and cuffed him, and so they're sending him back here, I guess, for a trial. Yeah. But that's, like, stop one of, like, 70, because it's one of those things where he's wanted on, like, thousands of charges by dozens and dozens of countries. So his dance card is full of, like, for the foreseeable future. Anyway... So now I feel like we got to play that again later on just so I can prove to myself that it can be done. It can be done!
And I'm looking at the clock, and we have Anna Griffin coming in today, and so I'm thinking we are not going to get to the clown porn today.
Well...
We're going to have to just have a special clown porn day tomorrow.
We could get to the clown porn, but it would just... I think it might necessarily color her impression of this program.
Yeah, we can't take that risk again.
And I mean, she
not after Lactime with all the penis talk.
She works for a respectable news organization, so I don't really know that I don't. I'm not really sure that we have a lot of.
In fact, I think you should like make sure that that's well out of sight, so you don't accidentally unveil it while she's sitting here.
It's hidden at the bottom of a pile of things. Maybe I'll put it in my bag, though.
I think that's a good idea.
Just completely like get it out of sight, out of mind, out of whatever. Hold on, let me just put the clown porn away.
As it is, I have another damn penis watch for today when she's here.
Well, we'll get rid of that before she gets in here.
Okay, yeah, we'll get that done quickly.
All right. It is 503-505-6964. We also have a musical request coming up later on from our listener named Kirill, I believe is his name. Kirill says, Rick, my wife and I are flying out to sunny Hawaii on Friday morning and are going to be listening to Thursday's show on the plane. The couple that listens together stays together, friend. So I'm wondering if you could play Blood Rock for us. Also, maybe that song Timothy about the cannibals in the well. Who's that? Who is that by? Never can find it, so you can play a bit of it. That'd be great, but at least Blood Rock. Thanks. Corey, I guess is his name. P.S. My wife will be happy to hear Blood Rock on the plane. She'll be terrified of flying after that. Best show ever.
So, another good reason to avoid the clown porn today, because we don't have to inflict it on this woman on her way to her vacation.
Yeah, I suppose.
He wants to play this song because it will make her more scared on the plane?
Well, my gut sense is whenever there's somebody who is requesting like the clown watch theme, for example, they normally want that because there is somebody they know, because they're not afraid of clowns, but they know somebody who is, and they want to, you know, sort of amuse themselves. Like, I had a guy one time who said he recorded the clown watch sound off the radio because he then made it the Windows startup noise for his wife, because she's terrified of clowns, and so she would turn off the radio whenever the clown watch happened. But he then so like rigged her computer so when she would fire up like Windows XP or whatever, it would have the, you know, and then the screaming and the whatever, just because he said, quote, I wanted to watch her jump. So the deal with Blood Rock, though, that is usually requested by somebody who is where they themselves are afraid of flying, but like they don't want to suffer alone. That's a misery loves company kind of a thing. Mm. So we'll play that later on. Okay. All right. Well, in any event, so let's get underway. This is Dawn Taylor. She is at the news desk.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Portland's Bureau of Transportation announced the addition of 11 bike boxes in downtown Portland, and the move has already been getting mixed reviews from bicyclists and cyclists. 2 years ago, the city painted 14 bike boxes on city streets after several cyclists were killed. Greg Raisman, traffic safety specialist for the Bureau of Transportation, says, we've been observing that bike boxes are effective for reducing conflict between drivers and bicycle riders. Raisman said Portland State University conducted a study on safety, which showed positive results. He also acknowledged that the increased safety has come with a price. Each box costs the city at least $4,000 because of the materials that are used.
It's funny, I actually just got a text message. It was said moments ago that Anna Griffin from the Oregonian was going to be here. And instantly, I got a text message on the Skype thing. It says, please ask her why I'm paying $6,000 in taxes for a bike box. I'm not even sure who that was. I think I closed it, but it is, so somebody asked that. So we will.
So are these the things that?
It's people... the green boxes at the intersection.
Oh, okay.
What do you? Right. I mean, that's
so
where.
And then you have a bike, so then you stop there, and then people, I guess, won't hit you.
Are you asking me?
I guess.
I mean, that's the theory, right? I mean, the theory
you,
is that
you
there's,
get around the town more than I do.
The theory is that there's a green bike lane, which then terminates. It ends in a large green box that is directly before, you know, there's the white line, you got to stop at it, a red mm-hmm. light. So it's like, you know, cars stop at this line. The green box takes up like, I don't know, maybe like a 4x6 space like in front of that.
Yeah.
And I guess then the theory is...
It's like a safe zone for them to be in?
Well, it's so they're not on your right, so that if you're making a free right turn, you're not turning across a bicyclist.
Oh, okay.
If that makes sense. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
So you're not kind of cutting into them when you turn to the right. But I don't really know that that actually works. I mean, I'm not even really sure that it's effective, because the reason for that is I don't really understand exactly how bicyclists are supposed to then... Like what they're supposed to do to get back into the bike lane, or when they're supposed to.
Yeah, that's what somebody just said in the text box. They said, what the hell is the bike box for? They park in front of you but need to get the hell out of the way when the light turns green.
Yeah, that's the thing I never understand because there's no – I mean, I understand in theory how it works, that there's a green bike lane that then effectively – it forms like a Tetris block where it goes straight and then it goes to the left –
and forms this box in front of the car. So you go from being on the right of the cars to being in the front. Then when the light turns green, though, there is no sort of marked path for them to get back to the right. Mm. So I don't really know. It seems like it's sort of a half solution at best.
Here's the thing, and you probably won't be able to answer this either, but when I drive to work every day, I come down 11th. I go up to Clay, and then I come down 11th. And there's these on the street, in the middle of the lane on the street, there's a picture of a bicycle and then these arrows. And I have no idea what that means. Does this mean that... Is this warning me that a lot of people ride their bikes on the street? Is this telling me that bicyclists have full right of way along with the cars, so I have to, like, and they're not going to be getting over to the right?
Well, that is the case. I mean, I don't know if that's what those arrows indicate.
But the thing is that these things are specifically painted on the street, so does this mean
is 11th
like
and where?
On 11th, all the way.
Is this downtown?
No, it's all the way. It's from Clay, here in Southeast, from Clay at least all the way to Division over here, where...
See, now I'm not even, and the thing is, I drive these roads every night, and I don't understand, I'm not really sure I even recognize what you're, you know, yeah, I don't even know that I know what you're talking about, I don't think
like,
I've seen it.
It's like the little picture of the person on the bike, and then it has these two arrows that come up this way, and it's in the lane, and it's right in the middle of the lane you're driving in painted in white as you're driving.
I don't think I've seen those. That must... we've had Greg Raisman, actually, who's the guy you were just quoting there for the Department of Transportation. He's sort of there. This isn't his title, but he's effectively, among his other tasks every day, is to be a liaison between the cycling community and the driving community. We had him on a couple summers ago when there was that whole thing where it's like bicyclists were just getting hit like every day. And we had him on to sort of get an answer to some of these things. And so he's a great guy. We should have him on at some point. But... But I don't really know. So that's maybe a thing that he could sort of he could help explicate for us. Yeah. One of the things, what that might be, and I'm just sort of guessing here. This is just a punt. What that might be is that might be there to remind you or to bring into stark relief the fact that the cyclists are not only allowed to use the full lane, but are in fact required to use the full lane.
Oh, okay,
that's the thing, so
don't be passing them because they're. You know, that sort of thing?
Yeah, because people will, they'll do this thing sometimes, especially downtown, where they will kind of honk at bicyclists and be like, get out of the road, move to the right. And it's actually downtown, not only are cyclists supposed to, you know, not only can they be in the middle of the road, but they are required, they can't be on the sidewalk, and they're really not supposed to be in the shoulder. They are supposed to act as a car acts. Maybe that's the case, like if you are in areas just outside of downtown. So maybe it's like once you...
Or just that particular street, because it is fairly busy and there are a lot of bicycles.
Well, and because people use that street, like these, like Madison and whatever over here, and Morrison, people use those streets to get downtown. They're basically straight shots to like First and the whatever, you know, down there by where you get on like NATO and stuff. So maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's a way of indicating like you're not downtown, but that rule still applies. Because once you get into the suburbs, it's like you're told, you know, you're allowed to use the sidewalk.
Yeah.
So
are you allowed to use the sidewalk though? Because
in like suburban areas, I believe.
Because again, that's another one of those things that most of my learning about driver safety and that sort of thing is still jammed into my head from when I was young and growing up in Southern California, and the area where I lived, where I grew up. You were not legally allowed to ride your bicycle on the sidewalk. It was against the law.
I don't know. I mean, this is why the bicycling thing gets to be so complex, because the bicycling thing is like, is the example I always use, the bicycle argument is like the absinthe discussion, where no one really knows what the hell they're talking about, and so that's why you end up having to get like a Greg Raisman guy in here to sort of explain that. I mean, it's sort of pointless now because we're heading into the fall, but I mean, you know, so, all right. I don't know. We'll figure it out. How many of those boxes are they making?
11. New ones? 11 new ones.
There's like $66,000. Have there been...
Yeah.
We should ask... I'm adding to the list now stuff we should ask her, but I'm going to ask her if there's actually been, to her knowledge, fewer accidents this year and how they can tell that it's because of those bike boxes. I'm not saying there haven't been fewer accidents. Who knows? Maybe there have. But it's like, how would you know? It's like you're trying to prove a negative. How would you even know that the bike boxes are the thing responsible for the decrease in accidents?
I don't.
It's poppycock, Don.
Balderdash?
That's exactly what it is.
Claptrap?
Yes. Yes. You've gone all higgledy-piggledy. I'm going munchy-wunchy on Twix of Toast.
It's difficult, difficult, lemon difficult.
All right, let's move on.
En route to Britain for a four-day visit, the Pope said the Catholic Church has not been vigilant enough or fast enough in responding to the problem of sex abuse by priests. Really? Vatican analyst John Allen weighs...
Is this a clergy watch?
This could have been a clergy watch. God, I stink at figuring out the watches. Can we start this one over?
Yes.
Let's make this a clergy watch.
We'll start this over. I should just play the Nicolas Cage thing and then like into the Dream Theater, into this. This has been one of those. It's been one of those days.
Hasn't it, though?
And usually...
This whole week has just been wacky, hasn't it?
It's normally a thing that I'm willing just to put on you and just to make you bear all of the blame and just put all of the guilt on your narrow shoulders for this.
Like when you asked me the other day if I was off my meds?
Yes. Well, no, it wasn't. Okay, now let's be clear with this, because you're going to do that thing where you're going to paint me like I'm some sort of a dick. You actually said... You were off your meds. I didn't ask that. You said that.
No, I said I was taking some pills.
No. That's not what you said.
No.
This is before the program. You said,
I said, I need some drugs, what I said.
Okay.
And you said, what kind of drugs? And I said, good drugs,
okay.
My drugs.
But see, you've just given
I
me
didn't
three.
Say crazy
you've just
pills
given me
or...
like three different statements and claimed that each of them was what you said.
At
what,
no point did
The last one is what you said. You
yes.
said, I need some drugs.
Right.
Now, you are a woman. You have openly discussed that you have prescription medications of whatever variety. Mm-hmm. Also that you're crazy. So, and I'm lumping myself in there as well. So when you say, like, I took some pills, that's one thing. But that isn't what you said.
No,
you actually said,
I need some drugs.
Therefore, a reasonable man might assume that perhaps there was a prescription that had either not been filled or that you didn't bring with you or that you forgot to take this morning.
I can see how that mistake might have been made.
So then when you seemed ever so slightly bonkers later on, I logically and I think, you know, reasonably jumped to the conclusion that maybe nature had given you, you know, I don't know, one too many synapses firing in the wrong direction that day. And that the mechanism by which you normally dealt with that, which is to fill yourself full of pharmacological wonder, that just hadn't happened, and so you were just acting a little nuts. But you're saying it's, in fact, the whole week, and it's not medical.
I think the whole week has just been a little bit crackers, you know, and it's not just me. It seems like other people are just acting rather oddly and responding to things strangely.
Well, we do get those weeks where there's just crazy in the air.
Yeah.
Well, like, and again, not to go back to the thing I get, but, you know, that the thing that happened at the top of the show where I forgot, because we have two different, nobody cares about this, but we have two different audio channels that we feed the show on. One does all of our in-between music, our interstitial music, and one does just like, you know, the stuff we're doing now, like the talking and the watches and the news cuts. And the thing is, when you start one, you just turn down the other. And I've done that, like four times a day for the last 3 months or something. So I've, you know, done it more or less without incident or error, except for today, when I just didn't do it. And so I just like left a Sinatra song playing while I'm playing the Nicolas Cage thing. And then I didn't realize it until I got a text message from Thomas Gill, you know, that was just like, hey, by the way, you're playing a Sinatra song over the Nicolas Cage thing. Well done. And then followed by numerous text messages that just said, hey, fail boy, why don't you, which is a thing that I don't typically do. That is the kind of error.
No.
That's what we call a Bush League error, Don, that I typically wouldn't make. So there's something going on in my brain.
You know better.
Well, I've gotten like so. Now we're doing the beginning of the show, in the middle of the show, where we're talking about last night. But just speaking for myself, it's not like I'm low energy in any way. I don't think that's a physical possibility for me. But I am going on like multiple. I've been doing this thing where I fall asleep at night. See now, Anna's going to come. It's just going to be like some big shrink session again. But I'm doing this thing where I fall asleep, and then it's like I can't stay asleep for more than like 90 seconds or 2 minutes, and I get this weird. I do this weird sort of like jerking awake thing as though you've just jammed one of my fingers into a socket of some kind.
Huh.
Where I, you know, kind of drift off and then sort of a, you know, sort of like when you, like when you're trying to stay awake at your job.
Or you feel like you're falling?
I don't get the falling thing. I get like an electrical jolt sensation. And then I just kind of go, huh! And of course, it wakes up Lara, who then, as soon as she makes any noise, then Philo, who by this point has like crept, because he's like a real mama's boy of a dog, he at this point has like crept up like as close to her as he can possibly get, like he'll sort of sidle up. So she'll wake up, which then freaks him out, which then makes Max bark, and then it just becomes a whole house that Jack built thing, and it just, you know, and then just like, then, you know, half an hour later as I'm able to drift off to sleep again, 90 seconds in, and then it's just like, you know, wash, rinse, repeat, like all night long. Jesus. So, and this is what, Thursday?
Yeah.
And it seems like this week has taken about 15 days to get through so far.
That's a long week.
And I don't think I'm just speaking for myself. It sounds like I'm speaking for, at the very least, you and I, and we're the ones who matter in this equation. So, Jesus Christ.
So I will say, instead of the clergy watch, since we're getting close to Anna Griffin coming in, let's do the penis watch so I don't have to say penis while she's here.
All right. By the way, the Rick Emerson radio program and all the concomitant craziness is brought to you by, among other folks, Mr. Michael Beatty. He is the owner of The Cleaning Solution. If only he could come clean my mind. 971-533-3211 is how you can reach Michael Beatty. 971-533-3211, The Cleaning Solution. There's a home or office cleaning and restoration. We'll talk more about that here in just a bit. What's that you say, Don Taylor? A penis watch?
Oh, yes.
I think we can do it. Here's your penis watch for Thursday on the Rick Emerson radio program.
Take a look at my enormous penis, and my troubles start a-melting away. I take a look at my enormous penis, and everything is going my way.
You know what I'm going to do? Just FYI for people listening to the stream here, I think I'm going to take the intro of yesterday's show, where I do the whole phone numbers and the year of our Lord 2010 thing, because I don't ever give the date. I think I just say, like, September. And I'm just going to edit that into the beginning of today's show. And then, so there's just going to, you hear like a real audible, like, if you can basically hear the scissors snipping, if you listen back to the download of the show later on, that's why. That's what I've done. I'm going to shift time and space through a series of brightly colored and decorative wormholes just so I can fix all of this.
Because you have that power.
That's right, Don. I have the technology at my disposal. Okay. Here's Don Taylor with your penis watch.
A 28-year-old substitute teacher was arrested yesterday afternoon in Sarasota, Florida.
I'm sorry, where?
Florida.
We was like, stop,
no.
Stop, you're spraying the babies, you're spraying the babies. They didn't even care.
I'm sorry, it's totally wrong.
Yeah, that's very wrong.
You shut up! Get off my back.
Let's try this again. A 28-year-old substitute teacher was arrested yesterday afternoon in Sarasota, Florida.
In where, Don?
Florida.
Yeah.
He faces charges of battery and exposure of sexual organs. After going into Walmart, taking a Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue from the magazine rack, heading to the store's toy section, and masturbating to completion.
Oh, come on.
A store employee told cops that William Tyler Black ejaculated onto the floor and wiped his hand on a toy along with rubbing his foot in the suspected semen on the floor.
Okay, really? Tell me there's no mugshot. Tell me there's no picture. Tell me I don't get to look at what this guy, his horrible visage.
There's a picture of him with his crazy
eyes. Let me look. Oh, wow. Okay.
He has crazy eyes.
It's like
he looks like a frat boy with crazy eyes.
He sort of looks like our old friend Adam Thompson, who worked at KUFO, but if he had short hair and was waving his penis around in public a lot, which is, you know, it was not totally outside the realm of possibility.
Employees reported that Black discarded the magazine behind some toys and proceeded to the front of the store.
Does it say what toy it was?
Oh, it does indeed.
Was it an aerial doll?
No.
Okay.
A police source told The Smoking Gun that the toy in question was a lightsaber of the Star Wars variety.
Wow.
And that the magazine Black used was the 2010 Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue with model Brooklyn Decker on the cover. Though published in February, the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue could still be found on sale months later at many retailers. When cops confronted Black, pictured in the mugshot that I showed you, he said he was in the store shopping for a toy for his daughter. He was hit with battery on a child count since investigators concluded that a reasonable person could believe that a child would come in contact with the fluid on the toy, being that it was left in the toy aisle in the store.
I'm so glad you did this now. If you had done this story later, it would have just been awkward on levels that I can't even... It would have been a breakthrough in awkwardness of, like, Gaussian proportions.
No, I didn't want to do it.
Thank you. All right. There you go. Let's... we'll just end this now. That's your penis watch for...
Take a look at my enormous penis. My troubles start a melting
away. No call for that.
I take a look at my enormous penis, and everything is going my way.
It is the Rick Emerson radio program coming up later on. Taser Watch. We also have today's Pop Culture Authority. Today's Pop Culture Authority answers the question, from where does Tennessee Williams come? Anna Griffin from the Oregonian will be here in short while. We'll also have a musical request, Blood Rock by request. Let's do one more, and then do you want to do the Pop Culture Authority as we head into this break, or would you like to do that later on, Don Taylor? What is your choice?
I could do it now. Do you want to do one news story, then
let's
Pop Culture Authority?
Let's do a story. We'll do Pop Culture Authority. We'll take a break. Come back with Anna Griffin from the Oregonian.
All right. The family of a Wisconsin native who was decapitated by a pipe bomb, which we discussed yesterday.
Did they find the head?
Well, they actually, I'm not sure if they found the head. They said they do believe he took his own life. In a statement obtained by the ABC affiliate in Chicago, the family of Colin Dalebro said, "We are devastated that our beloved son, Colin Dalebro, lost his 15-year battle with depression. We know Colin committed suicide. We have no other public statement to make, and we ask that our privacy be respected during this deeply painful time." Dalebro, 21, was found in Fitzsimmons Park next to Nichols Middle School by a man walking a dog early Tuesday morning. Police said the family gave them permission to interview their son's mental health providers, and the department was viewing him as a person with mental health issues. The Evanston Police Department would like to extend their sympathy to the father of Mr. Dalebro. Thank you for his cooperation.
Wait, but they say he took his own life, but he didn't have a head.
Yeah.
I mean, you said that this was in the vicinity where a pipe bomb had gone off. But this wasn't, the pipe bomb didn't kill him, though, because you said that, I think it was like blocks away, I thought.
Yeah.
How would you take your own life and then there's no head left?
Well, I guess if you were the one who exploded the pipe bomb, perhaps.
Right, but a pipe bomb's not going to throw you a block and a half.
It might.
No, I think that the answer, I don't think it, I think that's like, no, I don't believe that that's scientifically plausible. I mean, it's possible that you know more about pipe bombs than I do, because I don't know that much about them, but I mean, a pipe bomb is small, right? I mean, it is just like a length of metal pipe. It's not like it's a mortar or a landmine
well,
or something.
Be pretty big. I don't know.
I mean, not that I'm not willing to entertain the possibility. Also, here's the other reason why it wasn't a pipe. If it was a pipe bomb and if it was of sufficient whatever strength power to blow off to literally remove the guy's head and to throw him however far away from the head or the head away from him, then it seems like it would have just blown his body into little bits. Like they wouldn't have found the body. It would have just been like little confetti of that guy. So it wasn't. It didn't seem like they were just found him in pieces everywhere.
Well, they're saying that he acted alone, which leads me to believe that perhaps he had something to do with it. His body was found after a pipe bomb exploded in. Okay, the pipe bomb actually exploded in the park,
which is where they found his body. Okay,
a second unexploded bomb was found nearby.
Ah, okay, so maybe he was carrying the pipe bomb, and it went off, or he set it off or something, and it was aimed in either the wrong or the right direction, depending on how you look at it. And it was sort of a goodbye, Mr. Head.
Yeah, authorities declined to offer their theories about the second pipe bomb, but guessed that it wasn't meant to be a threat to anyone, a backup in case the first one failed. So I guess he was the one who blew off, and I guess it blew off his head.
Well, I mean, points for efficiency, I guess. I mean, if you're going to go out, I guess have a little bit of a dramatic flair to it. All right, there you go. Coming up later on today, we have a Taser Watch. Anna Griffin from The Oregonian will be here. And in just moments, we have Pop Culture Authority with Dawn Taylor. You can email us if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. You can also listen to the show later on via iTunes. It's also downloadable at rickemerson.com, of course. And the mobile stream is up and running at mobile.rickemerson.com, mobile.rickemerson.com. And if you would like to become one of the testers, I don't even know if we're still in the beta mode. I mean, it's been up for a while. I think we're essentially kink-free at this point, but who's to say? Mobile.rickemerson.com is how you listen to that. And if you would like the information for how to make that work for you, that is just tech, T-E-C-H, @rickemerson.com. And now, without further ado, it's time for another exciting installment of Pop Culture Authority.
Where is Tennessee Williams from?
From the Emerson News Network, this is Pop Culture Authority.
I'm Dawn Taylor. Considered one of the greatest American playwrights, Thomas Tennessee Williams lived a life that was not unlike the characters in his plays. He was alcoholic and Southern. He was very close to his sister Rose, who was diagnosed with schizophrenia at a young age and spent most of her adult life in mental hospitals, and was the likely model for Blanche DuBois in A Streetcar Named Desire, Laura Wingfield in The Glass Menagerie, and Clara Holly in Suddenly Last Summer, among others. He was also a closeted homosexual until he was outed by Time magazine when he was in his 40s. He was also not, interestingly, from Tennessee. No, Tennessee Williams was born in Mississippi and left home to attend college, first in Missouri, then at the University of Washington, and then finally at the University of Iowa, where he joined a fraternity. Because of his thick Southern accent, his frat brothers nicknamed him Tennessee, and Williams found he liked it. He later said, "It's better than being called Mississippi." He moved to New Orleans when he was 28 and adopted the name Tennessee Williams full-time. So, Tennessee Williams, not from Tennessee, but still a great playwright, something of a tragic figure, and a legendary character, just not from Tennessee.
The final word on the only knowledge that matters. pop culture authority from the Emerson News Network.
To shake. How does she know who I am? And why does she give a damn about?
I've got two tickets to Iron Maiden, baby. Come with me Friday, don't say maybe. I'm just a teenage dirtbag, baby, like you.
Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-505-6964. Thank you for joining us today. 503-505-6964. In just a moment, Anna Griffin from the Oregonian will join us to provide illumination and candor-filled wit about all things happening in our fair city. Don Taylor is tracking the following stories for you on this Thursday.
An officer firing is the recommendation over the Campbell shooting. Oregon's sweetheart.
Did I just catch you with a mouthful of something over there? I'm sorry.
That's okay.
What is it you're consuming?
I was just powering down my tuna salad sandwich because I realized I didn't eat earlier in between like I had intended to.
Okay.
And
I'm sorry, Rick Emerson regrets the error. I didn't mean to.
Sorry. And there's this whole dictionary thing and taser watching.
Awesome. This is the kind of perfected execution that you can expect throughout today's program. Jesus, God Almighty. There is something in the air. I don't know what it is. I have no explanation for it. I don't know if there's just like some sort of radon leak underneath the city as a whole that is causing all of this. Let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson program, chronicling every step of the life-size role-playing game called Portland. Anna Griffin, who writes a twice-weekly column for the Oregonian's Metro section, news and life in Portland and Multnomah County. Hello, Anna Griffin. How are you?
It's nice to be in this dark padded room with you.
Yes, I was just thinking that normally we hear from people occasionally, they'll come in here and it's sort of dimly lit and we have the curtains shut so there's no natural light of any kind that can come into the studio. And it does have a sort of, this is the room where they locked up Dreyfus after he tried to kill Clouseau for the 15th time feel to it. And sometimes,
or a goth teenager's bedroom.
Exactly. Like you just came, like you're on your way from Michael's Crafts to Hot Topic, but you stopped off to put up all your tapestries on the wall. It occasionally can seem a little, oppressive or off-putting to people, but we were actually just saying before we came on the air back from the song that you said you had you were feeling odd. Or you had a little bit of a fever. Or you were a little loopy or something.
The plague, something.
Well, Dawn, because you just had something the other day to which I have proven immune so far.
Yeah,
but
last week I had this kind of like I just don't feel good kind of a thing. Just a little bit of a low fever and just achy all over, but not so sick that I couldn't function.
Oh,
just like
that's the worst. Because what you want is you want to be knocked out so hard that you can sit at home and watch your DVDs and complain and people will listen.
Right. And people will take care of you and you don't have to feel guilty about it.
Instead of, why are you at work infecting me and whining?
See, that's the thing. It's like, and you don't feel, you feel well enough that you, if you were to stay home, you'd feel like you were just gold bricking, as they used to say. You were just loafing. And yet you go there and it's just, no one appreciates your work ethic. They just view you as some sort of walking, like you're some sort of outbreak monkey that's just spewing pathogens into the air everywhere. Not that I'm viewing you that way as such.
And if you do, like, say, a radio program, what happens is the person you work with ends up just saying after the show to you something like, what's wrong with you?
You know what?
Do you think you could maybe, like, act like you're having a good time and pay a little more attention?
Is this going to be like some like get-out-of-jail-free card that is just brought out of your figurative pocket every time you're feeling annoyed at me? Well, at least I'm not the one who lectured his co-host after the show the other day.
What I like is how it's working on the radio together is clearly kind of like a marriage for the two of you. It's like, these are the things I talk about
and
with my spouse.
It seemed like a good idea at the time, but then later, with the benefit of hindsight, one asks oneself, what would I do differently in my life? And the answer is things beyond measure.
We could talk or not talk forever.
I mean, before we even started the show today, I was just feeling a little wonkified. We had this huge debacle at the beginning of the program. This is a technical error, which was solely and completely my fault, by the way. And so we did the introduction of the show, and I know that we're just now sort of foisting all of our mental deficiencies onto you, which you know just handing them to you. But about 15 minutes into the show or something, I made some observation about how I was just feeling a little bit out of it, and that Dawn had been seemed to be a little bit out of sorts to one degree or another a little bit earlier in the week. But we came to the conclusion it is not just us, that there is like some sort of weird crazy in the air in Portland right now. And I don't know whether that's like a weather changing thing or if I'm just projecting my own like nutcasery onto the rest of the metro area. But
the hell mouth is opening.
That's what I mean.
And we are all feeling its effects.
Do
things just seem a little bit wacky right now?
It's the start of fall, isn't it? I mean, this is how like animals sensing the coming of
an earthquake.
We are responding to the coming of the rain.
Is this where we look and we'll see Sam Adams running down the street and stopping to sniff the ground occasionally?
In tomorrow's Oregonian.
Heading for higher ground. Before we
storing nuts for the winter.
Before we... Okay.
Was that a Breedlove joke?
I
really didn't intend it that way, but once I said it, I realized, oh.
That was one of those things where it's out of your mouth and you try to sort of inhale it back in.
Yeah.
And, oh, it's too late. Before we talk about whatever is sort of going on today, because I guess that there are, we might as well just ask, have they made a decision in whether to keep the officer on that was involved in the shooting, or are they just recommended something? I don't know how that works.
It's fun how these things play out. So yesterday, the police union sent out a statement and proactively slamming the mayor and the police chief for deciding to fire the officer who killed Aaron Campbell.
Had they made that decision, or was it a little bit of a reverse psychology kind of a thing?
Well, I mean, it sounds as if they've made the decision, but they're not going to acknowledge yet that they've made that decision.
I don't understand. Is this a thing where they don't actually fire him, but like his key doesn't work and he can't get anybody to return his calls and they're just hoping he'll quit?
Well, here's what's going to happen is they're going to meet with union reps who are going to give them all sorts of mitigating factors, reasons he should keep his job. They're going to fire him. It's going to go to arbitration and he's going to get his job back.
So he's not going to be, he wouldn't just take like a payout or something at this point?
No. He made a mistake that led to him shooting someone. I think it's one of those cases where it's not hard to look at it and go, there's probably grounds for you to lose your job.
Right.
But as we've discussed before, it is really hard in Oregon to fire a police officer for excessive use of force.
Is it hard to fire? Is that just because it's hard to fire like city employees in general or police officers? Is it especially hard to fire
those
guys?
It's especially hard to fire police officers.
Is that because they're cops, or is it because is there something specific in the way that the procedure is set up that it makes it challenging?
The ways the precedents have been established with arbitrators is the standards that you have to meet to prove that someone that a use of force is in fact a firing offense, that it rises to termination. It's much higher than any city can really ever meet.
We've got somebody here who we got this right at the top of the show, and Don had actually mentioned this. It says, can you ask Anna Griffin if she knows why those painted bicycle boxes cost $6,000 a box? Which, in all of this sort of, Don and I immediately, we did this thing where we kind of spiraled each other into a froth about an issue that neither of us had any information about. We have no facts, no knowledge. I can barely tie my own shoes. But within the space of like 0.5 seconds, I had gone from not knowing about this story to being outraged about it. And
while we still didn't understand it at all.
But like saying, you know, in the grand radio tradition, saying in like ever escalating volume levels and in a really authoritative stentorian tone of voice, exactly why I felt that this was just more misuse of my funds by the government and the fat cats contained therein. So lost in all of that is, what are they painting those this with that they cost $6,000? That didn't make any sense.
It's really nice paint. It's very bright.
I would hope so.
It lasts.
It cures cancer, I would hope.
Or gives cancer if you eat it, I think.
I mean, are they just making that figure up, or do those things really cost like $4,000 or $5,000? Do
well,
you know?
I don't know, but I can fake an answer. I think it's the cost of the paint, and it's very special paint, I'm sure. It's reflective and it lasts in the rain and it's not going to wash off and you're going to see it from a mile away. There is a certain amount of engineering that went into figuring out how those boxes, how they were going to look, what the dimensions needed to be. And I wonder if the $6,000 figure doesn't include the use of the city's employees' time.
And I wonder if it's, well, because they did this in other cities first, right? Like we got the bike box idea from elsewhere, from like Boston or somebody.
Yeah.
So I wonder if that is like some sort of a proprietary, like a design or like some sort of like a city planning
bike box trademark
strategy that like they, you know, like if they bring in some company that's like a solutions company to figure out like, hey, we got guys that keep driving into bicyclists. How do we solve that? And then there's some company that comes in and analyzes the situation and says, our conclusion is that you should put these bike boxes in, blah, 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 blah,
well,
blah.
Odds are if it's being done by government, somebody is probably being paid too much to do it.
Somebody's brother-in-law got a contract there.
And to be fair, according to the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, when they painted them in Seattle in the end of July, they said that they cost $15,000 each.
Are you kidding me?
You're also taking out. You're taking out part of the road when you do that.
Yeah, but now, is that true? Because I thought it was just like, when you say taking out part of the road, what do you mean?
Well, it's you're occupying part of. I'm not really sure. Did I mention I have a fever?
but at least we're all on the same level. It's just I'm not expecting you to have like the. I said that actually earlier that I felt like we were sort of like just throwing this at you with it, you know, because it just came. It just came over the wire or whatever.
Tell us why it works this way, Mom.
But it's because we were having this whole conversation about the hit and run that had happened, and whether this year was worse than the year before or the year before that, which was that, you know, that was the 2008, I think, where everything ended up in like some sort of mob riot where like bicyclists were attacking drivers. But that led to this discussion
Can we back up for just 1 second? I don't actually think there was a mob riot.
Wasn't there something where like they circled the guy's car and they were beating his car with a bicycle?
There was a case in which a bicycle was used as a weapon, but
and it was like a whole ring of people around the guy's car was, and he works for the Department of Transportation.
Here's the quandary that we have is that we want more bikes on the road. The more bikes we have on the road, the more bikes and cars are going to interact. And the more bikes and cars interact, the more dumb people are occasionally going to do dumb things. And we're going to go have incidents of road rage one way or the other. The bike boxes do cut down on people getting hit. I mean, people getting the sort of the right hook where a car turns right into you. Anybody who's spent any time as a bike commuter in this town knows it's... That happens. It happens on a regular basis to people, and it happens a lot more often than you hear about because oftentimes, you know, they're stopping and they're turning, so you don't get hit so hard that you have to go to the hospital.
Well, that's the thing that happened on, what is it, like Burnside and like by the Crystal Ballroom.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, here's a picture of the ones that they did in Seattle, which are actually a little more elaborate than ours. These are the ones they say cost $15,000. And they estimated that for the $15,000, the paint, which is an aggregate of crushed rock set in epoxy, costs $10,000.
Those rocks are emeralds, by the way.
And the additional $5,000 was for labor, because it takes special skills to actually put it down correctly.
Well, and what they're doing is, in some cases, they're either hiring private contractors or they're sort of prorating the salary of city employees who would be doing something else, who would be getting paid for that time. So to just say it's $6,000 is a little bit misleading.
So I think my final question here, now I've somehow just appointed you like the de facto head of all traffic regulations and improvements here.
The bike box expert right here.
So Don and I were trying to figure out logistically. So if you're in the right-hand lane, you're in the bike lane downtown, which on its face is sort of confusing too, because there's a whole thing downtown where you're supposed to act like a car, like you're supposed to be in the middle of the road by law, I think sometimes, so that you don't get hit.
Well,
by a car.
I know a lot of people who've gotten hit by car doors. You know, on Broadway.
Right.
As you're coming up Broadway, the bike lane is right next to parking, and if somebody isn't looking in their rearview mirror as they're getting out of their car, which is not a natural act for many of us. You've parked your car; it's not moving. There's no danger. You swing your door into somebody and. I mean, potentially you could kill somebody that way.
Yeah. And I mean, and then you get to the intersection and you do something where you're pulling like in front of the car, which itself seems kind of risky, because if you're pulling in front of the car, like as the light turns green, you know, and he hasn't registered the fact that someone is moving to in front of his car, but the light has turned green and goes forward. And then we were trying to figure out exactly how you turn right out of that, or if you're just supposed to keep going straight, or what? It's all very confusing.
Well, the point of a bike box is, you know, they're shaped at sort of an upside down L, and so the bike lane is green, a few feet leading up to the box, and then the box extends into the car, into the thoroughfare. I don't know what the actual technical term is, and the idea is that everybody's supposed to be hyper aware that bikes and cars are sharing space here, and the big green box in front of the car is so the car knows you have to wait to turn right until the bicyclist has gone past. Because most of us were stopped at a red light, and as a car, you know, you're in the right lane, you're about to turn right, light changes, or even it's a red light and you're making a rolling stop. You're just going to turn right. You're not going to look. And the whole point of a bike box is to make people aware you got to look out your rear view mirror, and you have to see if there's somebody there.
I will actually say that as much as it's easy to criticize journalism, especially electronic journalism, for just dwelling on terrible, awful things that happen and just, you know, freaking us all out with stories where, you know, a shocking incident in downtown Portland. And, you know, and then they cut to a guy standing in front of police tape with, like, the lights blinking in the background and an ambulance covering something with a sheet, you know, to terrify us all. That actually has had the effect of making me stop at a lot of intersections and do like the full-on head check over my right shoulder, especially on like Hawthorne, where I am just convinced, Like, I now just take it as an article of faith that I will eventually turn right on the, like, 39th or something by the Hawthorne Theater, and that there will be a bicyclist there who's just, like, whizzing by me.
I actually had a guy on a bike fall down in front of my car yesterday.
Really?
Which is, like, this... Which, fortunately, I was, like, creeping along very, very slowly, like, way far behind him, because I live in constant terror that a bicyclist is going to fall down and I'm going to run over him. It's just that it never happens. So you always think, I'm just...
Right.
I'm paranoid, but... You know. And, yeah, it was one of the things I was at... I had done my show at PDX FM, was driving down whatever that street is where it's the streetcar lane that goes down to the waterfront, and these three people cut across. They signaled. They were very, you know, safety conscious to go over to get into the left lane to turn left onto, like, Waterfront Road, First Street, whatever that is, NATO Parkway. And the first two did it, and the third guy, it was raining, and he's cutting across the streetcar
right.
tracks.
And he went down?
Yeah, front wheel of his bike into the streetcar track. And he just, boom, goes down.
Everybody who's biked in Portland has fallen on the streetcar track at one
point. And I was just like, and he looked more embarrassed than scared. And I was just like, well, thank God I'm paranoid about hitting people on bicycles and was going 5 miles an hour.
The only two times that I've ever really just completely and totally wrecked on my bike where they were on tracks, one was by Entercom. And that was actually just, it was completely dry. I tried to cut across the tracks, and I got the parallel thing where my tires got wedged down in it.
That's exactly the same spot. That's where I was.
Oh, see, and that's the other was when I was down the street from CBS, and it was wet outside, and I was trying to, like, cross the street, the intersection. I remember how it was, but my tires slipped on the metal, and I went, and it was like in rush hour traffic, and I was just lucky that I was actually obeying the traffic signals such that the cars weren't just sort of streaming through the intersection. It would have just flattened me. I mean, it was terrifying.
I would actually love to know whether, when they were designing the streetcar tracks, anybody bothered to say, how about we not make the gap quite wide enough
to fit a
bicycle tire? If we're going to be a bike crazy city, it seems like common sense. Because that, I mean, everybody... You know. Everybody has done that who rides a bike in this town.
No, it just seems really poorly designed.
I think that's just the way the design of those are, though, because I have friends in San Francisco, and people are going down on their bikes in San Francisco all the time, too, because of constantly having to cross light rail tracks.
It's good that the streetcar is slow.
Yeah.
Well, it's like, you know, Tim always used to make that observation about why the Max was so dangerous, because it doesn't look like it can hurt you. It just looks like this plastic tube of slow-moving fun. It just, you know, it looks like one of those spaceships from the original V miniseries that's just sort of like a plasticky egg container, you know? Like it's going to bump into you and you're going to, oh, you're such a cute little train. You don't really think of it like separating your spine or something. We're here with Anna Griffin from The Oregonian. She writes a twice-weekly column covering all things that happen in our fair community. Just real quickly, before we move into something else, something that you just wrote about was this Kirk Hanna guy. He's the guy, he owned the Mount Hood Ski Bowl. Mm-hmm. And that is the guy who had the whole hit and run happen. And we had talked about this story, but I didn't realize, because he ended up with what, like 30, it was like 30 days and $1,000 or something.
Yeah.
But that was like when he copped to the whole thing. I mean,
right.
he went to the cops and said, like, hey, I hit a guy, by the way.
Well, his lawyer went to the cops with keys to an SUV and said, here's where you can find this. I'm not going to tell you who my client is, and I'm not going to give you permission to search it.
Right.
And the cops went and looked at it and said, well, yes, you hit a biker pretty hard. Somebody hit a biker pretty hard. And then commenced this little dance in which Mr. Hanna's lawyers clearly needed to know whether he had killed someone.
Right. So that was the thing? Because he didn't... So they didn't know the status of whoever had been hit.
Well, it's the middle of the night. He's drunk. He's driving too fast. He drives away. He knows he hit something, but he doesn't know what. Meanwhile, the police, because the guy, luckily, the biker was not that seriously injured, it wasn't one of those cases where we have a fatal, and so the report shows up on the desk the next day.
Right.
Cops didn't even know they had a case until a lawyer came forward with keys.
Where was the cyclist?
It's on McAdam.
But I mean, he was hit and then, but he did go to the hospital. Did he go home?
He went to the hospital, and I think he spent a few hours in the hospital and then went home. And he had the injuries you would think he would have if you're lucky. He had a concussion and busted up bridge work in his mouth and cuts and bruises but nothing broken and. No serious life-threatening.
Boy, that's got to be just the weirdest sensation if you're that guy and you wake up in the morning, you're like, well, I guess I'm going to go to the store and get some milk. That's different. And you just look at the front of your SUV, and there's just like a huge concave, you know, the like bike-shaped indentation in the front. I can't even imagine how you, I mean, how do you, what do you even say to your lawyer? I mean, just, you know, I mean, did you say, look, I think, did, what, I, did
you
he
say anything you want to your lawyer because he's your lawyer, so,
right, but
you
I,
know.
But I mean, I see, but they
it's
say that, there's that, the, like the lawyer client privilege, but it's like, I guess I just instinctively disbelieve, you know, all of that stuff about how the conversation stays, like, you know, confidential. I think I just, in my heart, I never believe that any of that stuff actually happens. Like anything you tell your shrink, supposedly, you're supposed to say with your shrink. But I very carefully avoid telling my shrink anything that would, like, actually let her help me in any way or, you know, because I just sort of assume that, like, she's blogging it, like, under some, like, you know, for the Sun as some anonymous, like, the diary of Dr. X. I have a crazy patient who wears glasses and has a large nose in Portland, Oregon, you know, and it's... But with you, when you're telling your lawyer, like, look, there's all this blood in the front of my car. And so there was either like a huge woodchuck in the road or I hit a guy. Can you come over here now?
Wasn't there a story, a case in I want to say Texas for some reason, or California maybe, a few years ago where a woman, I think it was a woman, came out one morning and there was a dead guy attached to the front of her car.
He was in her windshield. He was actually, and he was still alive.
Is that the one who parked her car in the garage?
Yeah.
You just shut the door and figured, I'm just going to leave him there till he's dead.
Yeah. And I forgot all about that. Yeah, he was halfway through her windshield and still going like, hey, can you help? A little help here. Ow. And then he just, I forget what the upshot of it even
was. It took him like 3 days to die, I think, is
because I think she was like, I'm going to go visit my sister-in-law. And she just like took off and she was like lammed it for a while. And the guy, I think, eventually died. But then she, it did come out at some point that she had, you know, gone out to the garage and went, oh, okay, do not want. And just shut the door and just like, I'll come back later.
I think the lesson here is, kids, if you think you've hit someone with your car, do not just shut the garage door and go to bed.
That never works out well. All right. We're talking with Anna Griffin from the Oregonian. We will have more here in just a moment. Let's pay a visit to the news desk with Dawn Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Oh, let's do our Taser Watch.
All right, here is your Taser Watch for Thursday right here on the Rick Emerson radio program. There is your, you know, just real quickly on the don't tase me bro guy. First of all, I don't even really know his name, but I don't think that matters because everybody just knows him as the don't tase me bro dude. He, for some reason, he is in my mind inextricably linked with the dude you're getting a Dell guy. That Dell had, and then they like bounced him when he ended up getting busted for having weed or something in his dorm. And I don't know why, but I always picture the two of them living in some bad apartment, you know, like on the south side of a town somewhere and just... sort of occasionally looking at each other like across the room in adjoining armchairs and just going like, yep. And then just like going back to watching TV. I don't know where either of those guys went.
It's like a sitcom on NBC.
Right. It's like there should completely be a sitcom in which all of the characters are either thinly veiled versions of like those guys or whether they actually just have those guys, even if they have to be portrayed by other people. And Rodney Allen Rippey would be there too. All right. Here's Dawn Taylor.
Using his crying children as a shield in his downtown Aspen, Colorado hotel room Monday, Charles Brandon White allegedly told police, I'm a UFC fighter. I can take you. White fought three officers in the room, in the hallway, down a flight of stairs, and was subdued only after he was shocked twice with a taser and injected with a sedative.
Did he really say, I'm a UFC fighter, I can take you, while using his children as a shield?
Yes.
That tends not to underscore the seriousness of your threat.
That's the WWF. That's not the UFC.
Yeah, I think somebody's confusing something with somebody else.
White, 28, of Englewood, Colorado, is not listed on the roster of the Ultimate Fighting Championship League.
Wow.
Police were called to the St. Moritz Lodge shortly after midnight by White's girlfriend, who said he had slapped her face several times. Some of the same officers who fought White recognized him from earlier in the evening when they sighted him after a fight outside a pizza restaurant. In that case, he gave police his girlfriend's last name and a phony date of birth. When officers arrived at the hotel room door, White wouldn't answer. He initially pretended to be asleep with his children when officers entered with a key from the hotel manager. White then swore and yelled threats at police while clutching his young son and daughter, whose ages were not listed in the report. When officers pulled him away from the children and cuffed his hands, the fight ensued. Arrest records say White is about 5 feet 10 inches tall and about 155 pounds.
So he fought them down the hallway and then down some stairs?
Yes.
That's especially great because when I sort of visualize it, it's done in that weird sepia tone Keystone Cops thing where the movement's all jerky and there's like a rinky-dink piano like playing in the background. And then it just ends, though, with like a vicious tasing.
And then the injection of sedatives.
Okay, which, and let's just, for the record, talk about someone, and his name is Rick Emerson, who said last week on this very program that because the tasing never seems to, like, it never seemed to take. It's like the starter marriage of non-lethal police enforcement tactics, where they got to do like 5-6 times. I said that if they got a taser, and if the point of the taser as opposed to the stun gun is that the darts actually have to like penetrate your body and lodge there, that they might as well just do like some Marlon Perkins thing where they just zap you with it and then they just pump you full of like, you know, horse tranquilizers or something. So it sounds like somebody has been taking Rick Emerson's advice.
Yeah. White has been arrested in several Colorado – oh, wait. Actually, he's on probation for an assault in Oregon in 2007 where he was living in Bend. He also has a warrant on a failure to comply charge in Chaffee County, Colorado. He pleaded guilty to assault in Chaffee County in 2005. He's also been arrested at several Colorado counties since 1999, including on charges of assault, drugs, reckless endangerment, harassment, and domestic violence.
Well done.
He faces charges stemming from the Aspen incident, including domestic violence, assault on police officers, and child abuse. He's being held on $15,000 cash-only bail.
All right, there you go. There's your taser watch for Thursday on the Rick Emerson Radio program.
Don't chase me, bro!
I'm a UFC fighter. I can take you, said the 155-pound man.
I mean, you know, and I'm not saying that somebody's stature necessarily indicates that they would not be skilled in some sort of martial art. All I'm saying is this. Cops got a difficult job, and they bottle up a lot of stress. And just like we have all dated somebody who was walking around one day away from a nervous breakdown looking for someone to blame their whole miserable life on, you got to figure that a fair number of cops have really just been carrying a great amount of agita around, and they are just trying to find some sort of legally sanctioned way to release that stress. And if you taunt a cop or just tell the cop, like, come and get me, or I'll beat your ass, copper, or you'll never take me alive, you are going to be the recipient of all of that built-up anxiety. So, you know, which doesn't really matter to me because then we get a day of free entertainment out of it. But, you know, that's between you and the god of your understanding, ladies and gentlefolk. If you find yourself listening to the Rick Emerson Radio program and you say, by God, this is a fantastic conglomeration of stories. This is more entertainment than I, a mere mortal, could ever hope to receive for 32 cents a day. How is it even possible, Rick? How is it that you are even able to make this work in a structural sense? How can you just give every day for simply a quarter, a nickel, and 2 pennies? I will tell you how. It is because we have, of course, incredibly loyal and wonderful and I would say largely affluent audience who then choose to share with us their $6.99 a month, recognizing that is a small price to pay for quality and entertainment of such a high-grade nature. Secondly, we have a number of business partners, including but not limited to Castalia Language Center. They're a small private school in downtown Portland. They offer Spanish language classes for adults, and, of course, the classes are limited to just 8 students, which means that you're not going to do that thing that you probably did in high school where she'll ask you to like raise your hand if you have the answer to something, and you know that you don't really need to do it because there will always be like the one guy in the front row who's just there to polish as many apples as he possibly can, who will answer everything, which means you can just go back to defacing your peachy folder by making the one guy's baton into a dynamite stick. I mean, or whatever it is you did. The environment is comfortable and relaxed. Clara Grebel, who runs the school, is a native Spanish speaker from Argentina. She now runs Castalia Language Center in downtown Portland. You can find out more about it at PortlandSpanish.com. PortlandSpanish.com. And this is something that is an adults-only class, which means that you're not going to be there with people who are learning a different way at a different rate than you, and the class size is going to be very small, so you're going to be getting near individual attention. Please do tell them you heard it on the Rick Emerson Show. Castalia Language Center. They can be reached at PortlandSpanish.com. Once again, Dawn Taylor.
Soy un luchador UFC, puedo tomarle.
I have no idea what you just said. Is it something about milk?
No, I am a UFC fighter. I can take you.
Not at all about milk, then. I'm sorry. No. We're here with Anna Griffin from the Oregonian. Before we get on to anything else here, Don and I were talking about something the other day, and I had made a mental note to ask you about it. And this may be something that's totally like beyond your purview. We have so many stories that come across the transom here, like one a day. It seems to involve something about medical marijuana laws here. And I believe that within not too far from our studio, there's actually a, what do they call, like one of those, like the smoke-in places or something. It's like if you're a medical marijuana patient, like as opposed to just going and getting the prescription, which is also not that hard to do, I think, you actually go and then they just sort of, you know, that was a very knowing, that was a very knowing look that just flashed across your face right there.
I think if you want a prescription, I mean, let's preface this with there are many, many, many people in Oregon who legitimately have medical marijuana cards and need marijuana for anxiety or pain or whatever. But I do think there are certain operations where if you wanted a prescription, you could probably get one pretty easily.
So I guess our question for you is maybe it's not that you know the laws like backward and forward yourself, but I mean, is there any sort of even agreement on how those things work? Because we had a story about a guy who I think was busted for like carrying a bunch of weed with him or something, but he had a medical marijuana card. And so our whole thing was, then could you just take it like anywhere you need? Could you take it anywhere you take a regular prescription? Like, could you take it on a plane?
That's a great question. I think, you know, you can, again, this is secondhand. I think you can take, federal drug laws would bar you from taking it on a plane, would bar you from taking it outside the state, would bar you from doing a lot of things. I think within the industry that has sprung up around medical marijuana, there are, what they'll tell you is you can take a certain amount on a plane, and even if they find it, if it's a teeny amount, mm-hmm. like if it's clearly it's just for you for your 4-day business trip because you need it to sleep or whatever, you're not going to get busted for it because it's not worth the time.
I mean, I wonder if it's just one of those things where it's just going to take like a lawsuit or something. Like it will take some guy having his, you know, medical marijuana taken away from him at whatever airport and then going to court over it.
And some of it depends on the administration in Washington, whether it's a Democratic administration, which tends to be a little bit friendlier toward medical marijuana laws, or under the Bush administration, they were not happy about Oregon's laws.
Do they ever do like busts here or raids of any of the medical marijuana places? I mean, to the best of your knowledge, that
keeping in mind that I mean there are not medical marijuana places per se. There are a few places that have sort of cannabis cafe kind of places that have opened up.
But what's the difference? I don't mean to sound dense, but.
Well, it's not like California where there is a place that you can go and walk in and buy it. One of the challenges for people in Oregon, even after you get your medical marijuana card, you have to find a legally licensed grower to stay above board and legal. And it's not as if you can walk into a shop and you can't walk into a pharmacy and buy marijuana in Oregon.
So as a legally licensed grower, now but that's not a guy, he's not like a state employer. It's not like the state's weed. It's just like some guy, probably.
It's a guy. Many times people with medical marijuana cards who is licensed to grow a certain amount of marijuana, which will, I think, under the law, be given to people with cards.
All right. So that's if you yourself had the card or had the whatever, then you would be able to have like X number of, I guess, plants
or
something.
Exactly. And the idea is to control it so that you're not having people out there growing massive amounts that they're clearly going to be selling for profit, that you have people who are growing, you know, to provide to the finite number of people who have medical marijuana cards.
See, this is one of these things, it's a story, it's a thing that fascinates me because there doesn't seem to be like any actual concrete understanding of a lot of this, especially because some of it is just, as you said, there's like all of these laws that are in conflict and it takes, you know, it takes like arrests and lawsuits and court rulings to decide any of this. Mm-hmm. Guy just said in the text box, he said, if I have a medical marijuana card, does that mean I can smoke my pot at work as long as I'm 20 feet away from the building?
I don't believe it does.
It seems like it's either medical or it's not, though. And it's like if it's medical, I mean, I guess if it's one thing if like you're working at Freightliner or something and they don't want you like wielding a torch near everybody else. But I mean,
dude,
I mean, these are all the things. This is what goes on inside my head. What are the big stories that people should be following right now that they are not?
I like the role I'm playing here where I come on every couple of weeks and you toss completely random questions at me.
I like here, for example, we were going to ask you about the downtown beer laws. Like, no, you know, because
we're getting to that.
I can answer that question. I can do that.
But see, the thing is, I have such absolute and unshakable faith in your knowledge of Portland and how it operates. There is no one that has a sharper, more you know, keenly developed and intuitive sense of the goings on in Portland than you, Anna Griffin.
And I can also fake it quite well.
Here's the thing: even if you're going to say that, like, you don't really follow like the medical marijuana laws or whatever as such, like, you come into proximity with people who know a whole lot about a whole lot. So just by dint of doing what you do, you're going to be like way smarter about all this stuff than I am, certainly. So
there's a certain osmosis. Yeah.
Really, you're like one of the smartest people I know. So that's really where it all comes down. So we'll get to the alcohol story in just a second. Is there anything else that's going on right now that people ought to be tracking that they ain't?
Well, let's see. Yesterday we had Jeff Kogan, who's the chairman of the county commission, came out and essentially accused Mayor Sam Adams of holding the Selwood Bridge hostage. The city has promised to contribute $8 million toward building a new Selwood Bridge. The Selwood Bridge, if you've lived in that part of town or been there, it's falling apart. You know, they don't send buses over it anymore.
I said that to somebody the other day, and he said I was being alarmist about it. But there's like a sign on there that just says, like, if you're a truck, like, stop, turn around, do not pass this point.
The bridge is falling apart.
I mean, is it just... did they just build it wrong or something? I mean,
it's an old bridge. It's a small bridge. It was built back when Portland was a much smaller city than it is right now. It was built back in the days when Selwood was essentially its own town, and this was not a freight corridor. And so everybody kind of agrees that we need a new bridge over there. It's not like the Columbia River Crossing, the I-5 bridge, where you can have a debate about whether we actually need to build something new and bigger. The Selwood Bridge, we need to build something new and bigger. A few years ago, the city promised to contribute $8 million to the construction. And over the last couple of years at various meetings, the mayor and his staff have found many different things that they would like the county to do in exchange for that $8 million. And
such as?
Cede control of all the bridges in Portland to the city. Offer up support for the idea of a convention center hotel.
What would the city gain? Why would they even want them to cede control of the bridges to the city? It seems like then that's a big headache and cost for the city that they don't want.
Well, I think the thinking is that the city spends a lot of money on basic upkeep on roads and on bridges. The city is responsible for the roads, and the county is responsible for the bridges. It's kind of a logical disconnect there.
I guess I just don't. It seems like that's one of those things that if they don't take care of the bridge at some point, I mean, we will be turning on the news, and you know, and like the Schwann's guy will be going into the river, and then I cannot even fathom. Especially because it's not like a problem that's been hidden. As I said, like, there's big cracks on the bottom of it and signs saying, like, abandon all hope, ye who enter
here. Turn back now. It's like the giant from Twin Peaks is standing in the middle of the bridge waving his arms. No, Agent Cooper, no.
well done.
But it at the same, and part of what's weird about it is that the Selwood Bridge process has been really smooth. They've spent several years talking to people in the community about what kind of bridge they want, whether it should have bike lanes, whether it should have streetcar tracks, which exact spot it's going to go in, what the exit is going to look like. And so what it feels like is you have everybody on the same page except Sam Adams, who's off in a corner going, I'm not going to give you your bridge unless you give me what I want.
By the way, I just have to say, it's awesome that you described that by using a Twin Peaks reference, because in my head I was like rifling through my Tolkien. I was trying to remember the mines of, what the hell are the mines of, I want to say the mines of Marion or something, but that's not, but it's where they go, and then the watcher in the water comes out. Never mind. It's a thing. It doesn't really matter.
Hobbit stuff is lost on me.
See, but that surprises me. I mean, it's like you go to Ren fairs. I thought that it was like – I didn't think that – I thought there was like a poll test or something when you went to a Ren fair where they said, please not to describe the economy of Minas Tirith in no less than
– You never seem to have really understood that my years working at the Renaissance Fair were more about like
–
drinking heavily and getting laid,
okay,
than about actual historical reenactment or interest in fantasy.
I'm sorry, the Mines of Moria is where that has just been corrected.
I think all the poetry and songs in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. I think he lost a lot of women with that.
Well, I suppose. But
we can get our songs and poetry elsewhere.
I'm not. I am now. People are just typing in huge. People like in all things are, you shall not pass. In the text box. Thank you. I'm not saying that Dawn isn't 100% pure lady. But I'm just saying that you, I'm just saying it's not like the two are mutually exclusive. You're, I mean, you have interests that I would say perhaps in a generalized sense that would be thought of as male interests or pursuits. You know, a lot of things, such as like role playing type stuff and porn. Sure. I'm just saying.
Eating fried chicken. Scratching myself. Stuff.
You say that like it doesn't happen like 100 times a show, by the way. Let me just say this.
We all like boobies.
I have, I would say 5 or 6 occasions just within the last probably 48 hours, looked over and I've seen Dawn like backing up against the wall.
Like a bear up against a tree.
And then just kind of doing a sort of like roundabout sidling, sort of a
I think I'm allergic to something.
I'm just saying.
I need new body wash or something. I mean, I don't know what's going on.
I'm just saying, in terms of your interest, you are not what my wife would call like a girly girl in some ways.
No,
and so
I'm
it
not.
Surprises me that you wouldn't be into Tolkien. Because I just thought that.
Are girls into Tolkien?
Not saying girls, I'm saying the Ren Faire thing.
Being more of a guy girl.
I'm saying it's not like it's a requirement, but it surprises me that you're not, though.
No,
that's all I'm saying. I'm going to start like a land war about it.
My first husband and my second husband, both being big fantasy nerds, both tried to get me to read Tolkien, and I tried to appease both of them, and every time I just start reading, going, I can't do this. I have no interest. I just find it unreadable.
All right. Well, I'm not passing judgment.
I liked the movies, but not enough to like commit
There's
the
so
story
much
to
work
memory.
You have to do in those books to get through them.
Well,
you have to be so committed to it.
It really is, and that's why I sometimes say that there are no, you know, there's things that there are no casual fans of. There's no casual fan of The Wire. There's no casual fan of Lord of the Rings, because you either read it you know, like once or twice, which, and to be fair, I think I read all the way through once, and I think I read about halfway through like a second time. I had a sister, though, who she was like a freak for that, and like in her bed, she had like a map of Middle Earth in her bedroom, and like she had a whole, like she memorized like all of Tom Bombadil's songs or whatever, and they sang one at her goddamn hippie wedding in the park.
Yeah, I infuriate like my husband or something. I'll just be going, yeah, it was like that pretty place where Liv Tyler and the other fairy elves lived. He's going, Rivendell, that's right, or whatever it was, and he's like angry.
What you ought to do is you ought to just memorize a few character names from the last Airbender or something, and then confuse them with Tolkien characters occasionally.
Yeah.
Like just drop one in every now and again. Well, this is like I tried to get my wife to watch The Godfather, and because it's, you know, because it's what you do, and like the third time that she fell asleep, I was like, that's it. Like, I'm taking it out of the queue. And she feels really bad about it. She's like, I'm sorry. It was so long and nothing seemed to be happening. And I'm just, we'll watch it again. And finally I was like, no, this is, screw it. Like, I'm just, we're moving on to the next phase of your film education. I'm not even gonna bother with it. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's, there's just going to be certain things that you don't embrace. So I'm not holding it against you personally.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Why weren't we talking about that just now?
I don't know. I have no idea.
Let's talk about malt liquor. That's something we can all agree on. By the way, don't think that we didn't notice your twit picking that you did the last time you were here. That was the thing you didn't actually bother to share with us. So, Anna Griffin from the Oregonian, you were here a few weeks ago, and you came in, and it's pleasant and charming, and handled a lot of questions that you weren't prepared for very gracefully as I hurled them at you like Hialeah balls. And then later, I'm looking at my Twitter feed, and there's a lot of like, getting ready to go on the Rick Emerson show. Here's a shot of their disgusting refrigerator, which is just filled with mayonnaise and mold and hate. Here's a shot of, like, their recycling bin, which is just filled with malt liquor bottles. Liquor. Here's a shot of their other recycling bin, just filled with malt liquor cans. None of that is untrue, by the way. I'm not saying it's not a representative depiction of us.
Just documenting my time here.
So there are several people who work in the studio who are enthusiasts of malt beverages of all varieties, but... So what is the deal with them? Are they making it illegal, or is it illegal, or are they just debating? What is the deal with that in downtown Portland?
Well, they have huge problems with malt liquor sales, and the result of malt liquor sales downtown, with people who are intoxicated, is a polite term for it.
When you say problems, you mean like beatings, or just like a guy whizzing against a building?
Name it. I mean, drunk people, vomiting people, urine, bottles, broken bottles. And the thinking is, if you outlaw malt liquor sales downtown, you will dramatically cut the problems that they have. That you can still buy malt liquor in Portland and take it downtown. You just can't go to Peterson's right off the Max line and buy it.
Now, is it that they're going to be – are they banning the sales of it? Or are they banning – they made it sound like it was almost individual like a single can or something. Like they were just I think the story you had actually today said that it was single bottles.
Well, yeah, a single bottles of beer, but also all malt beverages more than 5.75% alcohol, and then fortified wines that are more than 14% alcohol. But also, yes, single bottles of beer and a single can.
And so you are essentially obligated. I guess the theory is then if you're going to buy a whole six-pack or something – that you're less likely than to get the six pack and then stand around in the corner and just like stab a guy in the eye later on.
Or yell at people who don't give you change. Yeah.
Just sort of forcefully accost everybody who walks through. Which is it's like in Utah. You know, I lived in Utah for a while, and they just have the strangest liquor laws in Utah. I think it is actually the case in Portland. If you are in Portland and you – because I don't drink and I'm lame in that way, so I don't know how this works. If you're in a restaurant in Portland and you order a bottle of wine and you drink half of it, will they do the thing where they reseal it somehow and then like it goes in your trunk or whatever and you can take it home?
I don't actually know the answer to that.
Because the different states are different about that. Like, I think in Washington
State, you could do that.
I think as long as it wasn't in the cabin, as long as it was in the trunk of the car, they would actually and there was something they had. It was like some little like wax thing where they would seal it shut and then you could take it home with you. And then when I moved to Utah, it wasn't the case. You had to, if you bought a bottle of wine, even if you just opened it and then, you know, you got a phone call and you had to leave, you couldn't take it with you. And so what people would do is, there's a huge problem with drunk driving in Salt Lake because people don't want to, you know, want to waste the $25 or whatever. They just drop in a bottle of wine. So be like, well, I guess we got to drink it. And so they'll just pound the whole thing before like waddling out to their SUV to sort of barrel home to the suburbs. And so when I heard about this, this was the same thing. I wondered if it was like people are going to be obligated to then pool all of their homeless money and buy a six pack together.
Well, and the problem with a law like this, obviously, is that it's a little bit elitist. I mean, you're going after the people who are going to buy one beer because that's all they can afford, versus those of us who can go anywhere we want on our way home and buy a, yeah, you know.
And the hope is, of course, that it will therefore encourage them to not be in that area.
Right.
It's not working on the problem at all. It's just trying to herd them out of, you know, the Pearl District.
Is it like,
say,
is this
where,
sort of,
the, yeah, where the yuppies are?
Is this like a an alcoholic Pied Piper of Hamlin thing where, like, you know, like they won't ban liquor sales. It's just like they'll gradually move the zone, you know, in which you can buy liquor until it's, you know, 40 miles away.
Somewhere.
Yeah.
I have the image of Billy Dee Williams in his Lando outfit, you know, leading
the
crowd out of town.
Come on, everyone.
No, he's just blowing on the bottle. He's just...
Hey, there's Billy Dee over there. He's got Colt 45. Let's go to Gresham.
like Billy Dee doing some sort of Emmett Otter impression. He's just sort of a, come on, everyone, let's go this way. And he's just like the jug band fires up and everyone, come on, everyone, we're following Billy Dee Williams out of town, I guess, to a garbage barge for some reason. I don't know why. Well, speaking, I'll tie this together in a second. Speaking of garbage barges, Dawn mentioned this story earlier and her theory that the city is just doing this to slowly herd all of the homeless people like away from the Pearl or whatever, which is not like, you know, not like that's so unheard of for cities to do. Whatever happened to that Dignity Village place? Is that even around anymore or is it just so far away we don't even think about it?
Well, yes, you just answered the question. It's out near the airport. It's a little self-contained, self-governing community.
Is it just like Lord of the Flies out there? I mean, it's like in the middle of just an old Lowe's parking lot or something.
It's just on a piece of land out in the industrial area by the airport, and people have made essentially huts for themselves and small houses for themselves, and they're tents and they have rules and they have a governing board, and if you are a pain in the neck, they will kick you out.
Really?
And you know, and advocates of the homeless use it as, I read someplace recently that they actually had a food cart somewhere in town that people from Dignity Village have started to raise money for various things out there. You know, homeless advocates point to that as, because it's going on 10 years now almost.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the first, because it was underneath the bridge or something, yeah, when it was here. And there's the whole thing where, like, bricks were getting dropped on it, like, from guys on the bridge. And, you know, and it was all very unpleasant.
And they essentially, the people who founded Dignity Village essentially forced the city to let them do something which the city is very loath to do, which is legally camp.
Right.
You know, there were a group of people a couple weeks ago who tried to set up something very similar to the original Dignity Village across the street from Portland Public Schools headquarters in Northeast Portland, and they were going to have all sorts of bylaws, and they had like a peanut butter and jelly station, and they were kicking out people who didn't behave, but a fight broke out, and the cops used that as all the excuse they needed to tell people to move on.
When you talk about the public, the no camping thing, is this related to that whole thing where they were all entrenched in front of City Hall for a while because that was the sit lie
yes.
thing or whatever? And so that was that part of the whole give us a place to live?
Yeah, the challenge is that even in the summer when there is ample shelter space available because, you know, it's not rainy, there's always going to be a certain percentage of people who, for one reason or another, would prefer to sleep outside. They have mental illnesses that keep them from wanting to be around other people. They have pets, and a lot of shelters don't take pets. They are traveling with a spouse, and most of the shelters in town are single sex. They're not co-ed.
I didn't know that. I thought that I guess I sort of assumed that there would be a lot of like family
there is family housing. If you have kids, it is easier to find housing. But for a man and a woman who aren't married
right.
but are just kind of traveling together, it can be hard to find a space where they can sleep together. And so for any number of reasons, there's always going to be a percentage of people who want to camp outside. The city can't say, yes, you can camp outside. They just can't because they're opening the door to absolute chaos
right.
on every street corner. So instead what we have is this, Don's absolutely right, what we have is this system now where people set up a camp because we're human beings and we like to, you know, we are social beings and law of the jungle, a group of us is going to be safer than one or two of us when there are predators out there, which there absolutely are if you are living on the streets. They get together and they camp. And at a certain point, either fights break out or rampant drug abuse breaks out or somebody bikes by and notices and complains about it. And so the cops have to go.
Sexual abuse is huge
yeah.
As well, the both male and female. You're just so vulnerable.
Well, because you're on the periphery yeah. of society anyway. And so right. you've got, it's not like like your law enforcement's number one priority when yeah. that happens. And people know that, which is why, you know, you get these misfit, like creepo, like apt pupil kids who, when they decide to go like wail on somebody, it's always a homeless guy, because that's what they move on to, like after the family gerbil or something, because they know that it's not like a thing that the cops are going to, you know, move on right away, just because there's only so many cops and there's a lot of crime to deal with, and homeless guys just, you know, crimes against the homeless just get sort of shunted to the side sometimes.
Well, also, and women especially who are homeless are victimized by homeless men, you know, the incidence of rape is just enormous. It's commonplace.
I'm fascinated by the idea. I mean, I guess I should have figured it out that it sort of has like become its own kind of community, as you said. It's like a self-regulating thing. I mean, that really is interesting. I am honestly surprised that there haven't been more like in-depth pieces about that, because it as much as the news sort of trends toward stuff that is. Because it is legitimately interesting,
yeah.
The idea that there's this like de facto, sort of tribe that exists out there that is made up of the homeless. I mean, I think that's a thing that would surprise a lot of people. I don't think a lot of people would know that.
I think most a lot of people do not get that when we talk about a homelessness problem in Portland, what we were talking about is a mental health problem. That the vast majority of people on the streets are there because they have some kind of mental illness or some kind of addiction, and they're not getting the treatment that we need. And so the challenge that we have as a community is we just keep herding these people from one spot to another. You know, I did a piece last winter about a group of people who were camping under the Hawthorne Bridge on the west side, and a month after I wrote it, the cops came and told them, you got to go. And what police officers will tell you is, basically what we're saying is you need to go somewhere where you're less obvious.
Right.
But people don't make the connection between taxes and mental health programs and homelessness. And I know, like in the 80s in California, they passed this sweeping Proposition 13, which cut back everybody's property taxes enormously. And all the people voted for it because, hooray, less property taxes. And one of the first things that got slashed was mental health funding. And the homelessness problem just skyrocketed in Los Angeles. Absolutely went through the roof. And it's like, and it was a direct cause and effect from the fact of all of these mental health places that would help people with their problems were now just, you know, booting them out on the street and they weren't getting any kind of help.
Well, you know, it's like my you know, my wife works she works with I'm always unclear about what I've said and what I haven't. She works with the mentally ill, but a specific kind of mental illness, a specific slice of society. And just through that one niche, I mean, you know, just the number of people who, you know, are just not able to get what they need, or not, you know, for whatever reason, are just not able to, you know, the resources or the whatever just isn't there to take care of them. And that's just in one tiny slice of the social strata. So,
well, the challenge is you can banning malt liquor sales downtown makes a lot of sense in terms of quality of life. But the flip side of it is you have people who this is how they self-medicate.
Right. Right. Well, and again, and you know, I am all for people being able to have just in Rick Emerson's perfect world, someday when I am the grand irremovable dictator of all creation, can be a couple of things. First of all, if you decide to reserve a parking space by standing in it while your friend circles looking for space, you're going to be killed. You're going to be killed. You're going to be killed in front of everyone. You're going to be killed, and then your lifeless body will be hung from the side of Macy's.
Who is more of the jerk in that situation? The guy standing in the space or the guy making his friend stand in the space?
The guy standing in the space because he should just tell his friend, like, get bent. Find us a better space, jackass. You're driving. I mean, that's the thing. Seriously, I was trying to park at Powell's. You don't want to talk about a group of people that ought to just be beaten with a hammer. I was circling and trying to find a space at Powell's. And look, it's not like I need to park right out front. I mean, I'll walk. It's not like I'm such some lazy load of a human who won't walk a couple of blocks. What do I care? It's just the principle of it. I'm just driving around, and in this case it was a woman, but it's usually a guy because he stands there and he like puts his hands on his hips like, nobody.
I'm a UFC fighter.
Yes, exactly. What are you going to do, tase me? Is just standing there holding a space, and I've actually done it. It's just a matter of time before they end up putting me in a small cage for the rest of my life because I don't know if you all have done this. You don't have to admit it now if you feel like you don't want your friends and relatives to know you've done this sort of thing. But have you ever done this where somebody is just being willfully obstructionist in the road just because they're feeling sassy that day? They're just like they want to be difficult. And or the guy standing out in front of Powell's, standing in the middle of the parking spot because he's waiting for a friend who's going to be there in a few and he wants to save the space for them. And I've actually done the thing in the past when I was much younger, of just sort of slowly nosing my car into the space and not hitting him, just which in retrospect was like the worst thing, because it's like then if you get the old person thing where your foot slips, then it's like, you know, then you're calling your lawyer and going like, hey, it's me, I'm the guy that owns the ski bowl. I think I nosed someone into a building. But just nudging the person out of the way. But the guy who is standing there, you know, is saving the space, that's the bigger jackass, really. It's like the guy who sits in the car, like, he gets out of his, you know, he's got his, like, he just came out of Pottery Barn, and he gets into his car, and he sits there for 20 minutes, like, leafing through the color catalog they just gave him, while someone is obviously behind him with the turn signal on, waiting to get into the space.
There's some really interesting profiling going on here.
So these are two guys.
They just went to Pottery Barn. They're on their way to Pals.
I'm just saying. What are you implying, Anna Griffin?
So there was some other thing you were going to do when you were
liquor.
I don't even know what I was talking about.
Drugs.
About the liquor.
No, I was just going to say someday when I am running the whole joint, I think there ought to just be. There's going to be a couple things, and then we will probably. You have like an actual job and things. You have to go be a productive member of society. So we'll wrap all this up here in just a second. We'll do. Here's what we'll do. We'll have to get to the top five tomorrow. We'll do a watch.
Okay.
We'll end the show. We'll play the Blood Rock by request. Okay. We'll play it on the way out of the show. Just real quickly here. When I am sort of in charge of everything as a grand, you know, grand benefactor slash tyrant of the universe, there are going to be just massive piles of books on every corner that are available to any and all who wish to have them. But then also, maybe in a separate section of town or maybe only at night, just big barrels of drugs just for anybody who wants them. Just have all the drugs you like. And the thing is, they'll be
what
free.
What could go wrong?
Would this be like Hamsterdam, or was this be...
It'd be like Hamsterdam, but sort of taken, and Dawn doesn't know what that is because she's only now working her way through season one after much berating on my part. It'll be like that, but we're going to go the extra mile. Not just a place to do the drugs. The government will give you the drugs. And maybe we do it like... Maybe we do it this way. Maybe we get a state where nobody's doing anything, like Wyoming, and we just send everybody there if you want to take free drugs. And we just say, look, and you know what? And we're going to come back in like a year. And that'll be a thing where either everybody has learned to get along, or it'll be a self-cleaning oven that has removed the issue, like for at least the next decade or so. You know what? You will have just put a little break in the degradation of the gene pool, like right there.
Come to Cheneyville.
I mean, all
the Xanax you need.
That's really, I mean, and that becomes a self-limiting problem after a while. The guy who takes too much heroin doesn't have kids who take too much heroin 15 years later. That's all I'm saying. What is coming up in the Oregonian that people need to know about today?
Tomorrow I'll be writing about the continuing search for Kyron Horman, which now we're up to $1 million it's cost us to find one sad.
When did they go on Oprah? Has that already happened, or is that...
It was today.
Was it today?
Yeah.
All right. I, what are you going to do?
We're giving each other similar looks. So.
Don and I had, we were talking about this the other day, and we did a little bit of a disagreement about this, because I don't have a problem with them going on Oprah, or with the dad wearing the shirt with his kid's face on it all the time. It's like I don't have a problem with people filing, if a family member gets killed and they file, a $40 billion lawsuit against the guy who manufactured the swimming pool, that whatever. Because, it's like they're upset and they got to do something with that. It's, in that instance, you fault, like, the lawyer who comes to try to siphon money off of their pain. So I have less of a problem with them than I have a problem with Oprah masking this as some sort of a public service. Because the thing is, they never find the kid, like, in Holland. They always find the kid a block away. So anybody who would know about it already knows about it. Anyway, yeah. I'm sorry. Rant over.
No, I'm with you. It makes me a little bit uncomfortable, because I sort of wonder at the end of the day, if the parents' goal is to force the stepmother into providing information she has not already provided to the police, how does going on national television and essentially accusing her of being a murderer or kidnapper accomplish that?
Is that kind of the upshot of...
Well, I mean, they've said in multiple media appearances, they have said that she has not been completely honest with the police. The Kyron's mother has come out and said, essentially, you're going to go to prison. All the evidence points to she is not telling the police everything she knows, and that's the reason that we're all talking about the fact that this kid is still missing and nobody knows what happened. What we are watching is not just the story of a missing child. We are watching the breakup of a marriage. And those are never, ever pretty, even when you don't have children involved and even when one of those children isn't missing.
Well, you got to figure it's all of the worst things combined. I mean, it's the marriage breakup. It's the whole business of the whether she was like sexting, and there was the whole sexting aspect of this, and whether there was the plot to, the alleged plot to have the gardener come like whack the guy or whatever, and the missing kid, and you add media to that, and you add the element of money, because there's the question of like where is money coming from to pay lawyers, and people are offering rewards for whatever, and it's just like this. It is just like this this oven, this autoclave into which all of the most instability-inducing elements are put.
I want to know who's going to play the cynical yet sassy newspaper columnist when the Lifetime movie airs.
I think we know the answer to that. In your breakthrough role and introducing Anna Griffin. By the way, I'm just going to end this whole segment with this phrase. You have now given me my Halloween costume idea. Thank you so much. I shall be going as the Pied Piper of Harry Hamlin. There we go. End. Let's pay one final visit to the news desk here with Dawn Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Let us do our clergy watch.
All right. We'll wrap everything up with your clergy watch here for Thursday on the Rick Emerson radio program.
I guess it would be nice if I could touch your body. I know not everybody has got a body like you. Cause I gotta have faith. I gotta have faith. Because I gotta have faith, faith, faith. I gotta have faith, faith.
Here is your Clergy Watch for Thursday with Don Taylor.
En route to Britain for a four-day visit, the Pope said the Catholic Church has not been vigilant enough or fast enough in responding to the problem of sex abuse by priests.
Get out.
Vatican analyst John Allen weighs the reaction in London.
Think that will be welcome to a lot of people who have been waiting for a clear signal that the Church gets it, although it also clearly will not be enough
with this guy's voice?
The Church's most ferocious critics.
All right. I
think that will be welcome to a lot of people who have been waiting for a clear signal that the Church gets it, although it also clearly will not be enough
for
the Church's most ferocious critics.
Is this like a performance act where he does like a cover of Andy Dick or something?
What's the deal with the Pope?
What is up with that? He has like that sort of weird squinched like Mo Rocca delivery going on. What is there to analyze with this, though? I mean, the idea that you're an analyst for this situation regarding the Catholic Church, I mean— That's a one-sentence analysis, I think.
Yeah, the Pope says, you know—
About the Rogerie.
You're right. We didn't really actually, you know, jump on this right out of the gate. And you're right about that.
I am stunned that a former member of the Hitler Youth would not be entirely forthcoming about the activities of his organization.
Allen says that this will be a challenging visit for the Pope on many levels.
Okay.
Trying to mend fences because of the sex abuse crisis. He's trying to argue that Christianity has something positive to contribute in a secular culture that often prefers to sweep it under the rug. And he's trying to mend fences with Anglicans, who he offended earlier this year by creating new structures to welcome their dissidents.
I'm sorry, a secular culture that often wants to sweep it under the rug?
Yeah.
It's the secular culture that's been sweeping this under the rug.
Don, don't be a bigot. Why do you have to be so anti-Catholic with your logic and your rational discourse? We will not tolerate that behavior. You know, there's just moments. You ever just, you know, it's like when you pass on a job, or maybe you opt not to go to a party, and you find out that like it would have been a terrible job, or something awful happened to the party, and you're like, you know, I'm glad I didn't do that. Few things are as satisfying as realizing in retrospect that you made exactly the right choice. And so when I look back at my decision to leave the Catholic Church, to not be confirmed when I was like 16 or whatever, which was not a popular decision with my family, with my friends, with the families of with the family of the girl that I was dating at the time, I have never had just a moment's regret about that. And stories like this just reinforce the belief that I was right to do that. So there you go. There's your Clergy Watch for Thursday right here on the Rick Emerson radio program.
Because I got to have faith. Oh, I got to have faith. Because I got to have faith. I got to have faith.
All right, Anna Griffin, you can read her in print in the Oregonian or online at oregonlive.com/Griffin. Griffin, there you go, GRIFFIN. And don't forget, the Rick Emerson Radio Program is brought to you by, among other folks, Mr. Michael Beatty, the owner and proprietor of The Cleaning Solution. So if you are at home and you're looking around and you're saying to yourself, my God, what a fantastic home this is. This carpet is sparkling. It's flawless. Its cleanliness is breathtaking. What can I, a humble carpet owner, do to make sure that it looks just as glorious a year from now, 2 years from now, 10 years from now? The answer is, write down this phone number. It's 971-533-3211, because the day will come, and probably soon, when a small creature of some kind in your home, be it a child, be it a dog, be it a hamster, be it a woodchuck, probably the woodchuck, really, of all of those things.
A gremlin?
The gremlins are less likely to do that. They when they do, it just becomes sort of a...
A chupacabra?
A chupacabra could do that, though. You want to write down this number. I have no idea we were going there. We just wandered into we just took an arterial there that went nowhere. And I was looking for some sort of a way out. And then I decided I just had to back up because there was no more going forward. Write down this number. It's the end of a very long day. And Don and I were crazy to start with. 971-533-3211. 971-533-3211. Mr. Michael Beatty, The Cleaning Solution. Carpet repairs, upholstery, stone, marble, tile. Pretty much if you walk on it, he can take care of it. And if you just bought it, he can keep it looking good for as long as you might own that. 971-533-3211. We want to thank Anna Griffin from the Oregonian being our guest today. Don't forget, tomorrow we are joined by Mr. Dan Clark, who will talk to us about Pirate Festival 2010, which is coming up. So thank you all for joining us. Don't forget, after a brief musical interlude, today's installment of Legion of News will encore, followed by an encore of this very fine radio program. Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network. At the news desk, it is Don Taylor. Advanced technology, magic provided by Thomas Gill. Executive producer is Cheryl Kanakoa. The Rick Emerson Show is made possible by a generous grant from you. It is Thursday, September 16th, 2010, and that is the frequency. Kenneth, thank you all for listening. Be safe. See you all tomorrow. Bye now. Thanks.
Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep is now concluded. Thanks for listening.
Broken eggs, I want the ceiling. Someone lays a sheet across my chest. Something warm is flowing down my fingers. Pain is flowing all through my back. When I look, I see there's nothing there. The face beside me stopped it, totally bleeding. The girl I knew has such a distant stare. The sheets are red and moist.